everyone. Welcome to episode 22 of the Home Hour podcast. I'm your host, Megan Francis, and we're here to talk about everything and anything that goes on inside the four walls of your home, feeding your family, your experience as a mom, raising kids, and keeping it all running smoothly. Today's episode is brought to you by eMeals, an online menu planning service that lets you create family-friendly, budget-friendly meal plans based on your favorite stores and the way your family eats. To find out more about eMeals and to get 15% off your first subscription, head over to thehappiesthome.com/eMeals. Okay, we've got a great episode coming up today. First, Sarah Powers, managing editor at thehappiesthome.com, is coming on the show in her first regular segment. Every few weeks, Sarah is going to come on the show to talk about mom stuff, caring for kids, caring for ourselves, everything that has to do with motherhood. And today, Sarah and I are going to be talking about a big topic, sleep. How to get more of it, how to help our kids get more of it, and more importantly, why you shouldn't feel bad if your kids aren't great sleepers. Hint, it's not your fault, and we've got some great stories that illustrate that. After that, I'll be interviewing Jenny Rosenstruck of the blog Dinner, A Love Story, and the book by the same name. Jenny has such a cool story. She's documented every dinner she's made since 1998 and has a really practical, down-to-earth approach to embracing dinner time and feeding a growing family. I just love talking to her, and I know you're going to love hearing her insights and how she makes her kitchen hour workout. But first, because I know this topic is heavy in so many moms' minds, let's get to my chat with Sarah about sleep. Hey everyone, I'm here with Sarah Powers, who is the managing editor at thehappiesthome.com and is going to be on the show with me to talk about motherhood from time to time coming up now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Sarah and I are going to talk about a topic that is near and not so dear to many mothers' hearts, and that is sleep, both how to get our kids to sleep, how to get ourselves more sleep, basically anything having to do with that precious, precious resource,
yes,
sleep. So Sarah, you right now are kind of in that thick of where the sleep issue is a big one for you. You've got a one-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Two small children.
Yes. Yeah. They're about to turn 6 and 4. So,
yeah. So where are you with sleep? And you've never really had good sleepers, have you?
No, I haven't. I think my first child was probably the best, but I think you don't really know what you have at the time.
Yeah.
My second and third, just not good, sleepers as infants. And I've heard horror stories of kids who are way worse sleepers. So I'm sure I fall somewhere in that majority middle,
right,
which is something that, I mean, that's one of the things I was hoping we'd talk about today, is that I think no one tells you, when you're a new mom, that sleep is kind of on and off for a few years. I'm sure you could attest to that, but
absolutely.
I think you focus a lot on sleeping through the night. That's like the big goal. And whether, no matter what your philosophy is or how you go about doing that, that's sort of like mostly what you kind of hear about as a brand new mom. And no one really tells you that like 3-year-olds could get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and 5-year-olds have bad dreams, and kids go through phases where they stall at bedtime, and they go through other phases where they wake up at 4 in the morning. And, you know, it's not like every night in my house is some sort of nightmare, but I think that was the biggest shocker to me, is that like, I really thought naively that once your baby slept through the night, you like went back to sleeping. And then you had another baby, and then you
got them
a couple
sleep
nights. It was
rough,
and then they slept through the night. So,
yeah. Well, first, let's talk about
this. This may sound really obvious, but that
no,
was like
I think
pick.
It's not. And you're right. Like, this, although my life now, I feel like I get more sleep than I ever have. That's compared to many years of getting very little. So, first of all, I want to talk about this notion of babies sleeping through the night and dispel a few myths here. This is something that irritates me, that it's become such a part of the collective, you know, conversation around motherhood, because when I was actually writing and researching a book about postpartum care for moms, I kept hearing about this mythical, you know, and that was a big topic. That was a whole chapter with sleep, because it's so important. And how do you get enough? And how do you get, if your baby won't sleep, how do you sleep? And how do you get your baby to sleep? And I kept reading all these different things like, oh, you know, most babies will sleep through the night, by 4 months old, or most babies will sleep through the night by X amount. And I thought, you know, in my life, in my experience, that is bogus. I don't know anybody who's had a baby that's consistently slept through the night, starting at 3 or 4 months, and has continued on. And right. then what I found out was that the definition, the scientific definition of sleeping through the night is any 6 hour stretch.
Right.
So think about that. If you put your baby down to sleep at 8 o'clock,
right.
then they're getting up at 4 in the morning.
Right.
Wait, is
right.
that 4? Is that 2?
No,
it's 2.
It's 2.
Yeah. It's 2. That is not sleeping through the night the way most people
right.
would think about sleeping right. through the night. That basically right. means that you have to put your baby to sleep, immediately fall asleep yourself,
right.
like immediately, you know,
right.
and then be prepared to get up in 6 hours and be happy
right.
about that.
Right.
So I think that there is a lot of mythology
yeah.
surrounding the whole baby sleep thing. And then there's the whole idea, there's the knowing that I know now after having 5 kids that you can get your baby, your 3, 4, 5, 6 month old baby on this great sleep pattern. And then they're going to hit a milestone of some
yes.
sort, and it's going to throw everything off.
And that feels like devastating, I think, when it's your first time. Like
yes.
when, you know, like it could be anything. They get a cold or they get their teething or something, something. You travel. We traveled a lot when my oldest was, she was a good sleeper as a young infant. And then we took like 4 trips in that like 3, 4, 5 month age range. And she got teeth at that age. Mm. And so at like 5.5 months, she was back to waking up like what I thought, like a newborn, like every 2 hours. So she wasn't starving at that age. And it just was like rocked my world. It was like, wait, you were sleeping through the night. You know, it's like personally insulting or something. I think once you once you kind of know that that's so normal,
right?
That it really, really is normal to regress like that. But if you don't know that's normal, it's just like, wait, no, we had this under control.
Right. And, you know, so much of what advice I give moms about everything having to do with motherhood is that whatever kind of mom you're going to be, I want to make it work for you more than I want you to worry about making it work for the baby, because I think babies are pretty
yes.
adaptable.
Yeah.
So for example, there are the parents who basically when they have newborns and infants and toddlers, they don't leave their houses between certain times of the day because that's nap time, and they don't ever stay any place past 7 o'clock because that's bedtime, and they don't travel because babies, you know, the babies can't sleep in a hotel room. And I think that that is totally valid if that's comforting to you to know that you can at least structure in some way the experience, even if your baby's not always going to cooperate, at least you mm-hmm. have that structure around it.
Mm-hmm.
We did completely the opposite because we're just a lot more relaxed in a way, but
mm-hmm.
also we were traveling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in several different places when we had little kids, and it was like we knew we needed to have kids who could fall asleep in a hotel
mm-hmm.
bed, or who
mm-hmm.
could fall asleep at a relative's house
mm-hmm.
and have that, or who could, you know, fall asleep at a nighttime event that we were at. And so we did have those kids. Now, the flip side of that was that their routine was not as I guess set in stone as a lot of kids. So sometimes there was more effort involved in getting them to sleep. Sometimes
right.
there was a lot more, like I had to really put myself into it. It wasn't like, hey, it's 1 o'clock, get in your, you know, go get
right.
in your crib and put yourself
right.
to sleep kind of a
right.
thing.
Right.
But what I will say now is now that I have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, there's nothing in their sleep patterns now which really resembled the sleep patterns they had when they were little. And I
right.
don't feel like anything I did or
right.
didn't do has made them into better or worse sleepers now.
Right. Well, and I think we should go back to something really important that you said, which is all of that, I think, is so important that it serves mom. In other words, if mom feels more relaxed and happier because of sleep circumstances in those like crazy first few years, the kids are very, very adaptable. And I think sometimes there's all kinds of great science about sleep, and I'm actually interested in some of it. So I don't think it's a bad thing to know how much sleep a kid ideally needs or whatever.
Right.
But I think what you're saying, if I can paraphrase, is that like the overall family dynamic and the sort of well-being of mom usually trumps a specific set schedule or a specific number of hours, and the kids are fine. Kids are fine.
Yeah.
Babies are fine. I am probably on the other end a little bit of that spectrum because I do kind of rely on naps and early bedtimes to get stuff done. I work from home without childcare and I have 3 small children. So to know like what my day is going to look like, I rely on that. But once my kids have been a little bit older and are kind of settled into their own predictable routine, I thrive on that routine, man. I rely on those two naps a day for a baby or one nap for a toddler. And so you and I are probably different like that, but I think we're the same in that we acknowledge that the kids will be fine either way. I mean, kids, unless you're truly depriving them of sleep, like mm-hmm. to an extreme degree, and really, you can tell when a child is suffering that way, and none of us want that either. So it's sort of a self-correcting problem.
Right.
Yeah. Routinely being kept up and snap, life is not going to be good. So it goes back to kind of flipping the typical discussion on that and saying what kind of structure works for mom and works for the family and the babies, especially the babies and the toddlers, they'll be fine.
I totally agree. And, you know, and sometimes kids are just rotten sleepers. And I was lucky. So my first baby, great sleeper, it must be a, you know, kind of a common thing. He was also the only one of my children who ever took a pacifier, which I think made a big difference. Mm-hmm. And none of them the rest I tried, they never would take them. So it was nice to be able to just kind of plug him up and put him to bed and he would sleep.
Right.
And the rest, you know, were varying degrees of okay to not so great. But my fourth, man, he had night terrors starting at about, it was after I night weaned him, which was probably around, I don't know, maybe 18 months. And I think that the reason I maybe didn't know before was because probably when he started to wake up or get scared, I would, you know, nurse him and then he'd go back to sleep.
Right.
And for whatever reason, when that was not an option anymore, he would ramp himself up from just like a little bit uncomfortable to like screaming, running around the house, like there was nothing behind the eyes.
I have heard.
He was not awake. Like he was in some kind of a semi-dream state.
Right.
And I mean, I remember like my husband and I getting up and putting him in the shower because we just didn't know what else to do. He was waking the whole house up, screaming at the top of his lungs, wouldn't stop. Now, I'm glad that was my fourth baby and not my first, because how demoralizing would that have been?
Right.
And there was a certain point where we just became kind of resigned to it and we knew it was going to happen 3-4 nights a week.
Right.
It was exhausting. And but the irony to me was that, like we were talking about at the beginning, was that this was after I night weaned. This was when I was supposed to start getting all of the sleeps.
Right.
You know, I was supposed to be starting to get 8 hours, 9 hours if I wanted of solid sleep a night. And suddenly I was getting even less than I had been when he was an infant. That was really hard. And it did last until he was about, I don't know, 4 or 5. And even now, he's 8 now and he's done, I mean, the last year he's really made leaps and bounds. But even as recent as a year ago, when he would wake up to go to the bathroom at night, sometimes he would have a hard time waking all the way up and couldn't find his way to the bathroom. So he would like end up standing in our room crying, but he couldn't figure out where he was or how to get back to his bed.
Right.
And that's really gone away. But you just don't know, you know, that you don't know which kids are going to be like that.
Right.
And there is a lot of sort of acceptance that has to be involved. Yeah. And there was, you know, we tried some different strategies and some worked to varying degrees. You know, it did really help for him to have a much more strict bedtime and certain routines and certain ways to calm him at night. But there was no guarantee. We could do everything right. And some nights he might just wake up and run around the house screaming.
Right.
So, gosh, I hope you don't have that to look forward to with any of your kids.
Well, my middle is – he does not have night terrors, but he would fit that profile in that, like, he just – he's 3.5. He'll be 4 in June. And just, like, when he's up, he's – often like incoherent or it's a bad dream. What I've heard about night terrors, I wouldn't quite put him in that category, but it's similar in that he's very disoriented and he's often very loud and like hysterically crying for no reason. And this is like when he's healthy and there's nothing.
and you want to do that thing like the face slap from the movie Airplane where you're like, get a hold of yourself. Like, what is wrong with you? And they're not even really registering you.
No. And in fact, he has had vivid dreams since he was like 18 months old, like really young to be having, you know, dreams where I could tell he was talking about something that makes no sense, you know, that kind of thing. And still, and pretty routinely, even when even when routine is normal and, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
So, I not quite the night terrors, but I would put him in that category of sleeper for sure.
So I want to talk a little bit about, now that we've established that, there's nothing you can do and you're just right. screwed. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But whether there are resources that have helped, there was a book that I'm not sure even this is still in print. I will look into it, but a book by the name of a woman by the name of Anne Douglas. And if it does still exist, I'll link to it in the show notes.
Okay.
But what I loved about it is that it was completely non-judgmental. So she mm-hmm. offered a lot of, so she kind of combed all the sleep mm-hmm. research and all the different sleep strategies from Wise Bluth to, you know, yeah. the no cry sleep person and all those, and sort of just compiled them all in one place. And it was like, here's something you can try. Here's mm-hmm. something you can try. And I just appreciated that it wasn't fear-based mm-hmm. and it wasn't like, this is the way you should be right. parenting your kids. It was right. more like, here's something you could get, you know, you right. could try, and then maybe it'll work and maybe it doesn't.
Right.
Did you ever have any kind of books that really helped you know, or other resources?
There's one book that I've gone back to a couple of times, and it's totally coincidental. I saw this woman speak at like some little, I was pregnant actually with my first, but I went with a friend who had a new baby. And so it was like at the maternity store where they brought in a speaker. I mean, I had no idea. I didn't like sign up for a sleep class. I just ended up there. And because I heard her speak and talk about kind of same thing, drawing from different approaches. I bought her book and I always kind of felt like I understood her a little bit better because I had had that personal connection. She goes by the name of the Sleep Lady, and her book is called Good Night, Sleep Tight, and it's been revised and we can link to that as well. And I would put it kind of like in the middle if you want to like call a spectrum. So I like that this book is sort of, it is kind of in the middle of a spectrum if you kind of go by sleep philosophies. And of course there's extreme ends. And then most people, I think, kind of can appreciate a logical middle place, and, or a lot of people can. And, that's kind of where I would put this book. And it does go up to age 5 too, which is nice. It kind of has, like we were talking about some of those toddler and preschooler mm-hmm. sleep issues. It has some good stuff about that. So we can link to that too. But that, I really only bought that book 'cause I listened to this woman speak when I was so new, and I was like, right. oh, and she really was, she was a good speaker and very, accepting and non-judgmental, just like you say, not like, not put, you know, selling a system that she had devised necessarily. So I think that was why I connected with that book. Not that it like solved my every sleep issue, but.
Right. I like that too. And it's hard because, you know, if you're an expert trying to get a book out there, or an author trying to make a name for yourself in this area, people want a system. People want to think that they can just do A, B, and
right.
C
right.
and get the result that they want. And that's why I think you have these systems and these strategies, which work beautifully for some people, but then don't always work for everybody. And right. then there can sometimes when they're so strident about it, it can feel really like you're doing something wrong. If
right.
you tried XYZ method and it didn't
right.
work,
right.
then, you know, if the author has put so much effort into playing up their system as the
right.
one, and
right.
then also making this case for like, if your kids don't sleep, they're never going to learn how to read and, right. and like all that stuff. Right. So there's so much fear around it, the
right.
whole sleep industry, that I almost shy away from wanting to promote any resources, except
yes.
that I know those two books are, you know, the book that I've suggested, and I'm trusting that yours is also kind of takes that middle ground approach. So
it does. And I think, trust me, I have been in that place where I wanted a system that worked. I really have. I can relate to that. I'm sort of like a systemsy type person, as you know. And
yeah.
while I don't think I really ever went hardcore, I can relate to the people who want those answers because I have been there and it has not been that long. So
right.
I think I kind of arrived at my own intuitive place, and I really like everything else. I think the more you talk to real moms, talk to people in your like social circles, the more you realize that all of this is just really normal. And so few kids are awesome sleepers. There are a few and you know them, but
right.
it's like such the minority. And I think that's one thing where when you just read the books, you feel like it's only your kid, it's only you, you're doing something
right.
wrong. And that's just when you talk to, so that's kind of the other side is the books, but also just being connected to other moms and moms who are a few years ahead of you who can say, oh yeah, my kid didn't sleep through the night till they were two. It's like totally normal. You
yeah.
know? It's just,
well, and you know, kids, it can be learned, right? And that's the other thing that I try to keep in mind. It's so funny that I was up putting my 8 and 10 year olds to bed recently, and one of them wanted to move his bed over next to his brother's bed. Their beds are on the opposite sides of the room. And I said, oh, well, what's going on? And he's like, well, I got to be close to William's bed because we're going to, and I can't remember the guy's name. Anthony something. We're going to listen to our Anthony something app. And I was like, what are you talking about? He said, oh, well, we have this app we listen to at night called Go to Sleep. And it just, we can't even listen for more than 30 seconds and we're both asleep. And so I went and looked it up and they had like bought themselves a hypnosis app. I don't know how an 8 and 10 year old kid find out about a hypnosis app. It was called, I think, Dream. I'll have to link to it. It was called Go to Sleep Now or something.
That's awesome.
And somehow they figured this out and it worked for them. And it's so funny because Owen had been having a lot of fears at night and was having a hard time settling himself. And the two of them just came up with a solution and it actually worked. I just thought awesome. And
that's great.
It just kind of showed me that my kids, you know, they can learn, there are strategies you can learn at any age. So even if you get off to a rough start, you can become more mature in your sleep. And kids are really smart and they can figure stuff out for themselves sometimes as they get older. So let's talk about moms though. Okay. So now that we've established like the kids, you know, that's kind of a crapshoot. We do what we can, but it doesn't always work. What about us? How do we get the sleep that we need? And I know you've probably got some strategies for that since you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it goes back to some of the common advice doesn't work for everybody. I have a tough time napping. Like say even my kids were napping in the afternoon or my oldest was at school and the other two were napping. No matter how tired I am, it takes me like 45 minutes to fall asleep, like at nap time. And it's like, you can like put a lot of pressure on yourself. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so sleep deprived. I have to take a nap.
Right.
So napping doesn't work for me. My whole family gets up early. So I don't get a lot of like sleep in opportunities. So I go to bed early. That's my strategy. I'm naturally more of a morning person. I'm really tired at night. And it's just not like it's kind of like the low my mood. If I'm really sleep deprived, I'm just kind of grumpy in the evening. Some people get a second wind. I think the kids are in bed and you're like, ah, this is my time. You kind of get a second wind. I don't. Not when I'm really sleep deprived. I don't get that second wind. And I just, I go to bed. So my strategy is based on kind of my body clock, which is not great in the evening, and our family's dynamic. My kids do go to bed early. We're sort of like just whether it's nature or nurture, how the kids have ended up, but we're sort of everybody, the kids and us are earlier to bed and earlier to wake up. And so I use that. I will go to bed like right after the kids if I'm sleep deprived. And I notice that those first few hours of the night are kind of the most important for me. After like, if I've gone to bed at like really when I'm really sleep deprived, like 8:30 or something, after like 12 or 1, if everybody's up and we're dealing with like kids awake, I'm fine. It's like I can like be the nighttime mom again, but it's like, you know, it's almost like a nap or something at that
right. It's like an early, yeah. I've had evenings like that where I go to bed super early and then I end up waking up again, but I feel so good just because I got those few super deep hours of sleep in.
Right. So I think, I think it's that's my personal strategy, but again, it's because that's what like my body needs. So I think sometimes you hear like sleep when the baby sleeps or take naps, or if it doesn't work, you got to find some other way to do it. I think, I don't know. What about you?
Well, I'm not a good napper either. I can nap if it's dire. Like if I'm really, really exhausted and the situation presents itself and the circumstances are perfect, so it has to be a dark room.
Right.
Yes. I will say as I've gotten older, I've gotten a little bit better at napping than I used to be, but definitely it's not my sweet spot. Napping is not really the best. However, I can nap early in the morning. So if I get up with the kids and I'm not an early – by the way, I have been going to bed earlier than I used to, and I feel that I'm shifting in that direction as I'm getting older, but I am not – I've always been more toward the sleeping in.
Right.
For me, like the perfect time to get up in the morning would be 9 o'clock, 8:39.
Right.
And the reality of my life is that usually I'm up more like 6:30 or 7 because I'm getting up with my kids. But sometimes I'll just lay back down after and also I have to say that my kids have all been in sleeper inners. They've all been the kinds of kids where they'll go back to sleep even if they get up early. And if I just say, can you just lay back down for a few minutes? They'll often fall back asleep. And of course now they're older. So even if they're up, I can get in another 30 minutes of sleep. But sometimes when I get the kids off to school and Clara is, you know, maybe having breakfast or maybe still sleeping, I'll just go lay back down and sleep for another half hour. And it feels really decadent to go back to bed at 8:15 or whatever time it is. But I get some of the deepest, best sleep in that 30 to 45 minute segment of time.
Yeah.
Now, when they were little and they were babies, I couldn't really do that as much. I really relied on the handoff with my husband. Like one of us would go to bed early, usually me. I'd sleep the first part of the night. And then he'd come to bed much, much later, but often would be up with the baby during that time. And then I would let him sleep in. But it kind of works out because we are both self-employed. It would be really hard if we were both having to get up and get out of the house at a certain time of the day.
Right.
And I think that's when you have to kind of, I mean, I know they say you can't make up the sleep on weekends, but sometimes you got to make it up somewhere, you know?
Right. No, and I think like having that, whatever your, like you and your partner's work schedule, I think at least feeling like you're in it together, I think has really helped us. And we do that too. Like we're, you know, if somebody's real, or like in the newborn days, you know, he would stay up later, I would go to bed, he'd be on duty, whether the baby was sleeping or not, it would be, you know, he was on call, you know, until as late as he could stay up. And then I'm better in the early morning, even if I've had a rough night of sleep, I'm just better. I could get up at 5 and have a cup of coffee and deal. Later I'll get tired, but I'm fine. So I think just feeling like you are part of a team, no matter what your system looks like.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it does help.
And the other thing I was going to say is when I was pregnant, I was really great at napping. And I sort of realized that especially this last two pregnancies, man, I was sleepy. I slept a lot. I realized that there were times of day, like I wouldn't have considered prime napping time, that when I was pregnant and desperate became like the times I would always fall asleep. And so now sometimes those are, if I'm really tired and just really need to lay down around 5:30, I will hit this wall where I can get in a most epic, like 25-minute nap. The kind where you wake up and you feel like you've been sleeping for a night.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, early evening is a good time for me to do that. So like early morning and early evening. Afternoon is kind of when I have my energy and I just don't want to sleep. So I think it's like you said, it's knowing your partner's schedules. It's being willing to have that back and forth, that give and take, and also knowing yourself and your energy patterns and you know, what you're like. And and then just knowing that eventually you will get through this.
Yep. This too shall pass. No, it really does. I mean, at least now we're in the stage where we go through like we were really sick. The kids were really sick a couple weeks ago. And sleep was really rough, but then hopefully as time moves on, those are shorter phases or you're able to catch up in between. It's not always like having a brand new baby where you know you're in for months.
Exactly. Well, we have to wrap this one up, Sarah. It's been great. Again, I'm with Sarah Powers today from Powers of Mine. I will link to the things that we talked about in the show notes. And Sarah will be back with us real soon. Sounds nice having you on, Sarah.
Thank you.
Hi again, everyone. Megan here. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Sarah Powers about sleep. Sarah will be back on the show in a few weeks to discuss birthday celebrations and kids with me, so look for that episode soon. I want to take a second before I introduce the next guest to talk about a post at the Happiest Home blog this week and how it relates to the interview you're about to hear. So the post is all about what I call the big old hunk of meat concept and how much it plays into our weekly meal plans. In the post, I offer recipes for 4 meat dishes: pot roast, roast chicken, roast beef, and pork loin roast. I just realized those are all roasts, plus leftover ideas. I bring this post up because my idea of a successful meal plan is something that's easy, family-friendly, and can be replicated week after week without having to think too hard about it or always consult recipes. And of course, the first few times you make anything, you're going to need to use a recipe of some kind. But my goal is always to get comfortable enough with something that I can just kind of wing it, which is why I don't have a complicated menu plan. I always keep it really simple and stuff that I can do a few times and then memorize. It also seems relevant to the interview because so much of what Jenny and I talk about is that it takes time and practice to develop confidence in the kitchen. In the post, I share that when I first started trying to feed my family, and back then it was just my husband and I only ever bought ground beef or chicken breasts, preferably the boneless, skinless kind. I was so intimidated by cuts of meat with unfamiliar names like eye of round roast that I just avoided them. But once I started experimenting with some of these big old hunks of meat, I realized that many of them are so easy to cook and so easy to build a meal around. It just took some experimenting until I understood that and had the confidence to embrace it. So if you want to read the post, just go over to thehappiesthome.com/meat. Again, that's thehappiesthome.com/meat, and you'll get 4 recipes for meat-based meals we eat all the time in our house, plus some leftover ideas. Okay, on to today's interview. Hi, Hi, everyone. I'm here with Jenny Rosenstrock, author of Dinner, A Love Story, and a blog by the same name at dinneralovestory.com. Hi, Jenny. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
I am great. I'm really excited to have Jenny on the show today because, Jenny, I think I understand this to be true. You have recorded every dinner you've made for your family since 1998.
That is absolutely true. In fact, I think I'm nearing my, what would it be, my 16-year anniversary, February 22nd, 1998. I don't know if I'm doing the math right there, but close enough.
Wow. Okay. And your blog, what I love about it is that you acknowledge that we all kind of think we could be doing a little bit better, and that the family dinner or the idea of these shared meals is something that speaks to us in some way and that we want to accomplish. So but that you're not judgy in the way a lot of, or not even judgy, but sort of a little hysterical. I feel like sometimes the tone around family dinners can become a little bit much.
Right. And I think that's definitely not an accident, because I was actually the person with the tone that was a little bit too much for a little bit of my professional career. I was working on, not sort of personally, but when you're working for magazines, you sort of have to take on this institutional voice, you know?
Oh, yes.
And the way the magazine industry frames family dinner, at least I found at the time, was kind of, it's a problem, and it's a problem we have to solve, which mm-hmm. is absolutely 100% true, but it was sort of informing the narrative in a way that that made me think, you know what, maybe if we phrase it differently than, you know, and I happened to really enjoy family dinner at the time. This was before I had kids.
Right.
it's like that mom who says, I was a great mother before I had kids. I was a great family dinner maker before I had a family. That's how I felt. But I thought, okay, there's a way to make this appealing. Instead, if you're going to frame something as a problem that has to be solved, then it's always going to be sort of framed as a problem. And a lot of the reason why I called my blog and my book A Love Story was because I wanted to kind of, change the conversation about dinner and make it something to look forward to, characterize it in a way that would motivate people and incentivize them in a positive way, and not right. kind of scare them into it, you know. Every year we read those studies about, you know, all those really scary studies about what's going to happen to our children if we don't cook food for them every night, you know, which are,
right.
I mean, there's studies and there's truth to them, obviously, and they're legitimate. But I think the way people interpret those studies, you know, it can be scary and kind of shaming in a way. And,
oh, yeah.
And so.
Well, and nobody wants to have to show up into their kitchen and do something every single night because they're afraid of what will happen if they don't. That is not a motivator.
No, not at all. Yeah. It just seems like, I'm kind of amazed that more people don't realize that, like, well, you know, that's a big reason why people have such a mental block about,
right.
you know? And, and so, you know, we do it every night, but it's not in any way, you know, I mean, it's gotten, we're very systematic about it now because we've been doing it for so long, but it's never smooth, you know, there's never, you know, last night I walked in the door at 7 o'clock and no one was in my house yet. You know, my husband had not come home from work.
Right.
One daughter was up at orchestra rehearsal, you know, a county away. The other one was at soccer practice. And, you know, dinner hadn't been started and we all sat down together, you know, an hour later, which is very different from the problems that we were dealing with, you know, 10 years ago, when it was really more about just, you know, like, is there going to be a witching hour tantrum?
Right. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
You know,
it does change.
So, you know, the issues change. There are always going to be issues. And, you know, sports and extracurriculars now is the big issue in my life. But it's, you know, I think it's all people feel like no matter what the issue is, they can relate to the fact that it's tough and you have to sort of, you just have to commit to it and think about it, you know, all the time.
Well, and a couple of things that you just said brought up some different points in my head. First of all, I used to write for magazines quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And I always found, because I did a lot of writing about parenting. And so, you know, the dinner time conversation came up in a lot of the stories I was pitching. And there always seemed to be this sort of irony because on the one hand, they really wanted stories about how we were supposed to be savoring the meal and enjoying each other's company and making a routine out of it and da-da-da.
Right.
But then all the recipes were presented as like this 15-minute dash.
Right.
Like whip together dinner as quickly as you possibly can.
I know.
And I felt cheated because I always felt like I'm trying to throw together this – like maybe the point isn't that I spend as little as time as humanly possible getting this meal on the table so that we can all stare at each other for an hour. Right. Because that's not terribly realistic either. Like maybe the making of the meal.
Totally. I mean, I actually have, I wrote a blog post about it, about that exact topic called, I think it's called Making Dinner Happen as opposed to Making Dinner, you know?
Right.
And the process of making dinner for me is so much bigger than just the, you know, 2 minutes and 20 seconds that you're like, you know, inhaling your beef stew, but, right. which can happen with little kids, especially, right. you know, you're like, oh my God, I just cooked for an hour and dinner is done that fast. Like what, you know, it's very frustrating. And so, you know, I try and I get that comment from readers a lot, like, how do you solve that? And the way to solve it is to sort of, again, kind of psychologically convince yourself. And it doesn't, it's not that hard, that dinner is about, it's a bigger process. And it's about, you know, if you're, the setup of your house allows, it's about like one kid doing their homework on the kitchen table while you're chopping onions, and another kid, you know, even if they're watching TV, it's like sort of near you and they come in and grab a carrot and dip it in hummus, or, you know, it's just like a, just the idea that everyone's gravitating towards one place at the end of the day.
Yes, is, I love
is,
that.
Is the feeling that I crave so much. And it really, I mean, it's such a cliche, but I don't really care what's on the table.
Right.
You know, I do, of course I do, but you know, on those, a lot of time it's just, it's people say like, well, what'd you have tonight? And I'm like, well, we had chicken and rice. It's really
fun. Right. Like, yeah, no, totally. When we get, that's almost the secondary, you yeah. know, what's and, actually on the table is the secondary concern.
Yeah. And I'm not the first one to say that, but it is actually right. true. You know, it's just, yeah. I think the hardest part about all this is not the actual cooking. For me, at least, I recognize for other people it probably is, but the hardest part is sort of all the logistics involved in getting to that point, that place in the first place. You know, like I'm working on my next book, and it's very much a step-by-step how to make family dinner happen kind of book. And yeah. it was so funny because I turned in, there's one chapter that says like a step-by-step guide for, you know, using this book, which is basically how to make dinner happen. And I did 8 steps, and then it was like, you know, go shopping for the week and look at your calendar and plan a couple things for the freezer. And they're all like very specific things. And then I kind of stopped at like when you walk in the door, and my editor wrote back. She, the first comment she said was, what about dinner? You didn't even say when you're making dinner. And I kind of had this light bulb went off with me where I was like, oh my God, you know, dinner is, it's like that's the icing. That's like the cherry on top. Everything right. else is done. All the planning and the think work ahead of time, that should be, you should just kind of walk into the house and be like, okay, I kind of know what I'm making. I have all the ingredients for it. I know it's going to be, you know, I've figured out what recipes are my wheelhouse, so I can do it without looking at a recipe, and I can kind of do it on autopilot while also talking to my children. And so that part should, you know, that should be the easy part. I realize that that's going to, a lot of people would disagree with me on that, but that's the place where I'm trying to get, people who read my blog, I'm trying to get them to that place. And
well,
just,
you mentioned someplace on your blog that that the internet is full of recipes.
Yes.
And it can be so paralyzing. And I know that, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been one of the people who said I hated to cook because I didn't know how to cook, really. But that was, you know, that was just one problem.
Right.
The other problem was I almost had this huge disconnect between the way I thought dinner would come together. So, and I've worked from home for about 10 years. So I would be really hardworking, you know, my head's down in my work.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's 5 o'clock and I kind of come up and I'm like, oh yeah, do I have any food? And I had not even thought about it. Like that whole day had gone by and never once had the fact that there was nothing in my house to cook
right.
crossed my mind, because I don't know, I just wasn't thinking about it. Like it wasn't part of my routine. And once I sort of made that the planning and the shopping and the just having a plan, even if it's the simplest, you know, what somebody who looks at Pinterest all day would think was very uninspiring.
Right.
Then the cooking part just happened.
Yeah. I mean, it just has to happen. You
right.
know, no one is winning James Beard Awards for their dinners. You know what I mean? It's not,
yeah.
sometimes we get really inspired and we make some really great things on a Tuesday night, but no, like for the most part, we're cooking for our kids. And by the time, I mean, I'm a little bit different from most people because, you know, obviously my job is kind of intertwined with
right.
coming up with dinner ideas. So I'm thinking about dinner all the time just because I need a post for the next day, or people just find it when they see me, they always you know, it's like this natural inclination to just talk to me about what they ate last night. And so I'm always getting ideas. I'm always talking about dinner, which I love. But, and so it makes it easy for me, you know. And, but, you know, for just in terms of just planning, it's not something, you don't have to think about it all day. You just have to kind of do one thing. You know, I have a big section in the next book about this, but, and I touch on this a little bit in the first book, but the idea of thinking about it first thing in the morning, which sounds slightly obsessive, but you actually don't have to do a lot to sort of get the ball rolling on dinner. If you want to, I mean, the hardest part is deciding what to make, and that's a big one. But let's say, like right now, the post up on my blog is this chicken that my sister had at her friend's house that she couldn't stop talking about. And so I said, what was so great about this chicken? And she said, I don't know, I'm going to ask her. And she found out it had been marinating for, you know, like years and years. And it's usually the trick with making chicken good. So for some reason she was like, oh, it was mayo, olive oil, agave, salt and pepper, some fresh herbs, you know, something like that. And I was in my car. I just dropped the kids off at school. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to make that right now. I have all this stuff in my pantry. And I just, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning and, you know, it was easy to do. You know, you just dump some chicken in a marinade. And then it, like, yes, it's marinating and it's going to be flavorful and delicious, but more importantly, it's on the way to being dinner, you know, like you have that decision made. You don't have that hanging over you. You don't have that moment when you know, it's 6 o'clock and you turn off your computer or you come home from work and you're like, oh my God, I haven't thought about dinner all day. You know, if you just let yourself check off one task in the morning, it's a huge psychological hurdle.
Well, there's something very comforting in knowing, like, you know, the roast is in the oven or chicken is in the bag or whatever it is.
I mean, it's
having
like
that. And I don't think that that's obsessive. I mean, I don't think about dinner all day, but I do think about it first thing in the morning because it does shape the way my morning goes and the way my afternoon's going to go. So
absolutely.
Even if it just takes a minute.
Yep. And yeah. And a lot of things sometimes do, you know, it's like, even when you don't know what to make, it's just like chopping an onion or you know, putting a pot of water on the stovetop.
Yeah.
Like, even if you don't know what you're going to make, sometimes that even helps. Because if you always need a pot of water or something, you know, it's just nice to have that. And, so it's just, you know, it's really just about, the most important thing is just committing to it. That's the hardest thing to do. And it's not easy. It's really not easy. And, you know, it's changing your habits. But, like, you know, the good news is that you're, like, when you first have kids and it's just, it's so, it blows up your whole idea of routine already. So I kind of feel like, well, that's the perfect time to adjust your life. You know, it's the older you get, I'm realizing the harder it is to break out of these habits and routines. And so if you're given this moment of, like, you know, a complete chance to start over, like when you have kids, it's really your whole life kind of begins anew, then it's a great time to sort of, even though it's hectic and chaotic, it's a great time to really think, okay, how am I going to figure out a way to prioritize this part of my life, which will actually bring me a lot of happiness and satisfaction.
I think that a lot of times, and I have older kids now, my youngest is, will be 5 next month, which is really hard for me to believe because my oldest is 16. So I've been in this for a long time. and I think I've noticed just by observing people around me and going through it myself, there seem to be two shifts that are like a little bit dangerous. One is the we just had a baby takeout thing. So you just had a baby. You're not really going out to eat, but there's always that, honey, can you run out and pick something up? Can you run out and pick something up? And that's really easy to get kind of mired in. I know that I did that when I had babies.
So did I.
And then when they get older, it becomes a we're already in the car anyway, let's just hit the drive-through. So there's like those two almost like danger where you almost have to retrain yourself out of that, out of those, that pull of the drive-through and that, and your life changing.
We just did that like 2 nights ago. I'm like on my way back from soccer practice and we drive by Smashburger and I can't remember the last time we went to a Smashburger in the middle of the week, but the girls said, oh, I really want to go to Smashburger. And I was like, are you crazy? You know, we just spent all this money at Trader Joe's over the weekend. We have dinner at home. And I was like, you know what? Let's just go to Smashburger. It was so satisfying. And they couldn't believe it. It was like breaking the routine. And
well, and it's when you don't do it all the time.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is exciting and it is fun. And we really broke our fast food habit over the last year or two. And I'm not even really sure how it happened. I think for me, partly it was because I started to enjoy that kitchen routine so much that it didn't occur to me to go pick up dinner.
Right.
But now, you know, so at first the kids would be like, every time we drive past McDonald's or Wendy's or whatever, we don't have a lot. We're in a very small town, so we really have like the fast food and that's about it. We don't have like, I'm not sure if Smashburgers is mm-hmm. like a fast food chain where you are, but
yeah, it's just one of these like sort of, you know,
regional ones,
quote, good burger chain.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I wish we had one of those, but, and the kids would beg. Mm-hmm. And then after a while they kind of forlornly stopped begging. And I actually heard my son in the way back say, my 9-year-old say, what's the point of asking? She's just going to say no. But then when you do say, hey, kids, let's go grab a burger, they're like, it's so exciting. So it is makes it more special for them. And
it's the whole point of like rituals is just
right.
So that you can, it's like, you know, why have rules if you can't break them? That idea. So,
right. Absolutely.
But also like just to get out of that habit, it is so helpful to do a shop for the week on the weekend mm-hmm. because you know, it's like paying for the gym membership and then not going to the gym. You know, you just feel right. so beholden. Like when I have stuff in the fridge and I'm going out to dinner, I'm like, what am I doing? This is such a waste. And, you know, I can see the clock ticking on certain vegetables and I just feel so guilty. And that guilt is the perfect motivation.
Right.
As if we're not guilty enough already about everything else. But, yes. So that's one tip that I always give people who say like, what's the best place to start?
And just plan that weekly grocery shop.
Yeah, have some sense of what you're making and then shop for the week so that you have options when you come home.
And you can also, you know, for me, like, I think at this point of our lives, because now we have 5 kids and they're all kind of off in different directions and we're kind of at the point now where 3-4 nights a week is probably what we're going to do where we're actually all sitting down together. So I really try to plan for you know, what I call fend for yourself dinners or like leftovers on the interim days.
Yeah. That's great.
But the funny thing is that now it's like, I'll get to the point too, like you were all be thinking about like, okay, so I have, you know, 4 cuts of meat in the fridge or 3. And then I've got like, how am I going to piece this week together? Mm-hmm. So that the nights I'm cooking, you know, there's like a gap day in between with leftovers or how is there going to be room in the fridge for all these leftovers? So it does become almost just a way of thinking.
Yes. Yes.
And it becomes very easy. It's not like I sit here all day, like staring at my fridge.
Right. No, I know. A lot of it is just like the more you do it,
right.
the more ideas are swirling in your head and the more confidence you have. Like for you, you're obviously a good cook if you're not thinking about dinner all day and then you're going down at 6 o'clock and thinking about it for the first time. Like that takes confidence and you don't just get there by deciding to be that cook. You have to actually have some meals under your belt. And so, you know, the easiest, you just have to do it in order to get comfortable. And, you know, I have a whole list of recipes that are just, you know, these are the most basic no-brainer pocket beginner recipes. And if you know these, then you're set. You literally don't need to know any more than like 4 or 5 recipes on autopilot and you're set, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I don't think that I'm a great cook. I think I do like 4 things well.
Yeah. And that's all you need to do.
That's really all you need.
Yeah, totally.
So I want to back up really quick because you mentioned the other night, and how old are your kids now?
Almost 12 and 10.
Okay. So you've moved into that time of life. It's different, right?
Yes.
And one thing that I think people get stuck in a lot of times, and I know for myself, this was a little bit of a hump I had to get over when my kids started doing a lot of extracurriculars and that kind of thing, is the idea that, you know, we sort of have this romanticized version of what it means to have a family dinner. And it means, you know, dad comes in the door at 6 and puts his briefcase down and then right. like it was when we were growing up or yep. generations past. And then we all sit down together at 6:30
right.
and eat. And I used to feel, I'm not going to use the word guilty. It was more like this feels wrong if I serve dinner at 7:30 or 8 on a school night. And then I finally realized, well, what difference does it make?
No. Oh, you mean in terms of how late it was
or like just the fact that I serve dinner some nights at 6 and some nights at 8 and it doesn't have to be the same.
Yeah. No.
Night to night. It's like we can mix things up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. There's just, I feel like you're just never going to do it if it has to look a certain way every time, you know? It's like, it's that perfect is the enemy of good concept.
Right.
You know? And yeah, I just don't know how, I mean, I'm sure some people know how, but I certainly do not know how to integrate dinner every single night in the same exact way at the same exact time, given that my children are moving into this phase where they have athletics and commitments that, right. You know, unfortunately, you know, it's a systemic issue. Like, I don't know why they have soccer practice from 7:30 to 9 o'clock. You know, I'd like to think that everyone, you know, the person in charge is not happy about it either. And it's just the only time they can get playing time. But, you know, it's just the option is to not play soccer and do something that she really loves. And I'm just not ready to have her give that up, you know, just for dinner. So, you know, if it's the school play where she has one line, I don't know.
Right.
That's a different story. I would talk her out of that. But, you know, it's all, I think it's for every family, it's going to be different, but yeah.
It is. But I think that sometimes when I allow, you know, like again, it goes to being willing to break up the routine a little bit. So most nights, say we eat at 6:30, but then there's that one night per week when I know we're not going to finish dinner until 8:45.
Right.
Well, that just means my kids are going to have a snack late, and yep. They're going to go to bed with very full stomachs. And it's actually, there's something actually kind of sweet about it. We're all sitting around the dinner table. Half the kids are in their pajamas.
Yeah, it is.
And we're eating dinner right before bed, and it's weird,
uh-huh. But
it's a little messy, but it's modern. It's modern parenthood. That's what we are dealing with today.
Totally.
And I don't like the idea of trying to like pigeonhole us into this way of eating dinner or this way of living. Either you're, you know, very traditional and you eat dinner or you're not. And that's,
It's not going to work if you try to do that. So it's, you know, you figured it out, obviously.
So Pat, talk about your transition, because you had already started this project where you were documenting and you were working for magazines doing food editing, and then you had babies.
Yes. I started the diary in 1998 when I was, it was just before I was started working for Real Simple magazine. That was my first job in magazines. And it was a great place to learn everything about, you know, writing and editing. I really loved working there. And then I moved on to Cookie magazine, which was a short.
Oh, I remember Cookie.
Parenting lifestyle magazine, which also taught me, you know, just so many invaluable lessons about design and writing and editing and food. And I just have worked with so many talented people in my magazine life that I just consider myself very lucky. And at one point I started writing. I was always like sort of at both of those jobs. I was in the food department, but I was not the recipe developer. I was just kind of the food enthusiast who was lucky enough to be assigned the food sections. You know, my job was to conceptualize the stories. So I would say, you know, let's do a story about, what's a good example? Like, I've only done 7,500 of these. I can't think of an example, but you know, like 100 rules of dinner, for instance.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I just put that together with the recipe developers, and we'll flesh it out with some recipes and some concepts and some interviews and reporting with chefs and whatever. It's just like it's called a package in marketing magazine.
Yeah.
And so I did all of these, and then I would just edit the regular columns where I would work with recipe developers. And, you know, some of those stories were like 5 ways to roast a chicken. And then, the everything you need to know about garlic. And so I was assigning and editing these stories, but I wasn't necessarily always writing them or coming up with the recipe ideas. In fact, I was never coming up with recipe ideas. And, you know, for the longest time, I always, you know, people would say, oh, you're a food editor at Real Simple, or you're a food editor at Cookie. You must be like an amazing cook. And I never had the confidence to say, no, I'm not, you know, I always used to say I'm the word person in the food department. I'm not the food person. And then, you know, it was so funny. Yeah, I had such a complex because the people who were working, who I was working with were just so professionally trained cooks, chefs, a lot of them. And I just learned so much from them. It was amazing. And finally, when I lost my job at Cookie, I had been working on a book with them, and I just loved that process. And then I started the blog, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to try to write after editing all these thousands and thousands of recipes and cooking. You know, I was cooking without recipes at this point. You know, I was sort of comfortable in the kitchen enough so that I didn't need to follow a recipe. And, you know, I very much taught myself how to cook that way by following recipes to the T. And so I just started, you know, kind of writing down what I was doing. And it came very easily to me just because I was, you know, I just had been practicing for so long without even realizing it. And so anyway, I don't know if that answers your question, but
I was thinking of it, you know, you had already kind of started this process and then you had kids, and I'm just wondering how that looked different, you know, because you'd already made a commitment, right? To cooking. Like you, this was something that you were already in.
Yes.
And then you had children. Okay. I think a lot of times people come to it the other way.
Yeah. I mean, we had, I think it was just because I married someone, who like myself, like was just used to ending the day sitting down with someone to eat dinner. And it was sort of it wasn't even discussed, like, okay, as part of this marriage, we will always have dinner together. Right. We never did that. But it just so happens that we both really like to cook. And at the end of the day, we would, you know, it wasn't nearly as organized as it is now, but, you know, we would always cook for each other and sit down and, you know, whine about work or do whatever we talked about before we had kids. I don't remember.
Right.
And then, you know, it was just sort of like, oh, well, of course we'll keep doing this when we have kids. And then, of course, we had a baby and we were like, oh, my God, how is this ever going to happen again? And, you know, we still, you know, there were some bumps, but we still did it. It was just, you know, I defined family dinner very differently. You know, like we would sit down and feed Phoebe her dinner, you know, her little mashed apples and whatever else. And then put her to bed, and then we would pour a glass of wine and make some beef stew or, you know, whatever. Right. We had a nice arsenal of fast dinners at that point in our lives. So, but we always did it. We always had dinner very, you know, I mean, there were nights, of course, when we were so starving and we were just eating while we fed Phoebe something else. But
yeah,
you know, as a general rule, it always sort of looked like that. Even if we were eating after the kids went to bed, which I know a lot of people would refuse to do, but somehow, like, I think if you enjoy cooking, it doesn't feel like a slog, you know,
to do two
rounds.
I'm wondering if there are any, concessions you made that you never thought you would, like, again, in the whole, I was a great mom before I had kids kind of a thing. Like when it came to insisting your kid had a certain table manner or that you did dinner a certain way, whether there's anything that you realized after you had a baby, like I know for me, for one thing that I've kind of realized with, especially having a large family, is that it always kind of became okay with me if the youngest kid, especially if they were like a toddler, didn't stay at the table. Because it was more important to me to get everybody else sitting at the table.
Yes, yes.
And so I would be like, whatever, I'll just kind of chuck some food at the little one and they can. And then what happened was, as they grew, all the kids learned how to become functional family, you know, members at the table. Did you have any experiences like that where you had to make a concession?
I mean, oh my God, all the time. I was sort of, I don't want to say I was adamant about it, but when I pictured dinner, I pictured it looking like, you know, we're all going to sit down and eat the same thing. And pretty quickly, you know, I had a very, very picky eater. You know, when she was in her toddler years, like my little one would barely eat anything. And pretty quickly I realized that if we were all eating the exact same thing, then we were all going to be eating, you know, plain white pasta every night. And that just was not going to fly. And so, you know, and it's easy for people to say, oh, we'll just put it in front of her and you know, she'll eat it if, you know, she'll eventually have to eat something. And she had weight problems and it was very hard for me to do that. And I just couldn't do it. I needed to see her gain weight and to watch her sit through a meal eating, you know, a raisin and a piece of strawberry it was torture for a mother. And so I would happily, and to this day, I will happily, you know, spread peanut butter on a piece of bread if it means that I get to, you know, enjoy my spinach and egg omelet, which neither of my children will touch, you know? So for me, the whole goal is like, I want the dinner table to be a place where people are happy. And it's something like, I remember as a kid just being like, it was such a safe place for me and I looked forward to it. And I, you know, the draw was the food. It was something I was excited about. And as soon as you just like put something on the table that, you know, you think your kids should love, but they don't, then you're setting yourself up for disappointment. And you're also kind of like, you know, you're saying, you're making it kind of like you're taking the happy part out of it.
Right.
Tell your kid, okay, we're going to have this pork stew with butternut squash and sage. And they're like, what's that? I don't want that. You know, if you tell them that, first of all, don't ever tell them that.
Don't ever tell them. Yeah, just those say, words are, yeah.
Don't ever say, you know, because then they start thinking, oh God, I'm going to have pork and butternut squash. What? Like, and they start dreading it and it's not fun and exciting. And, you know, it's fun to sit down to something delicious. And if you're taking that part out of it, you know, even if something delicious for a kid is defined as pasta with butter, you know, it's very important to me, and I didn't realize that before I had kids. It was very important for me to make the table a place that was happy, no matter what means necessary, you know,
and welcoming to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
you
and
know,
I get
so
into a lot of trouble
of...
for saying that. A lot of people will not.
There's a lot of, well, there's just a lot of judgment surrounding food. And it feels like there people have to kind of like put you in one camp or the other, like either you're a hard nose or you're one of those, what people like to call short order cooks, blah, blah. I think there's so much, I mean, you can serve a meal and give a kid who doesn't want the main part of the meal some rice or a piece of bread. I mean, it doesn't have to be this, like you're cooking seven different meals.
No, of course. And, you know, the other thing is for me, I have two kids, so it's easy for me to say that. If I had five kids, I have a feeling my philosophy would be a lot different. So, again, it's just making it work for your family, obviously. What I'm doing is working for me. And, you know, hopefully what I've been writing about helps some people on different levels.
I love that. Well, this has been great, Jenny. Thank you so much. Again, when is your next book coming out?
August 26th. So
August 26th. Okay. Yes. So fairly soon. I'll have links to all of the things that we talked about in the show notes. And I know you've got a lot of resources on your site as well for like, what kind of a night is it?
Yeah.
Is it the night you don't have any time, you know, that kind of stuff, go to these recipes. So I'll be sure to include those links as well. It's just a really great resource for if you really want to have this family dinner experience and just don't know where to get started. So, I've really appreciated getting to know it over the last few months, and I'm sure listeners will too.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Jenny. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye. That's it for this week's episode of the Home Hour podcast. As always, I'm so grateful that you've invited me into your home this week. To find out more about some of the things I talked about with Jenny and Sarah today, head over to the show notes at thehappiesthome.com/episode22. There are also directions in the show notes on how to leave a rating or review on iTunes, and if you could do that, I would so appreciate. I love hearing when people like this show, and it also helps the show get bumped up higher in search and just make it more likely that other people will find it. If you listen to the show right on thehappiesthome.com, that's great too. I would love for you to leave a comment or drop me an email letting me know what you're listening to, what you like about the show, and what you'd like to see in future episodes. So feel free to leave a comment on the show notes post, which is at thehappiesthome.com/episode22, or drop me a line at megan@thehappiesthome.com. Again, that's Megan, M-E-A-G-A-N, @thehappiesthome.com. And don't forget that you can get a 15% off of your first subscription to the online meal planning service emails by heading over to thehappiesthome.com/emails. I'll also put that link in the show notes. I am loving the email service, and I know that you will too. That's it for today. I'll be back in a week with another great episode. Until then, best wishes from my home to yours.